Greetings, Radio Free GOP listeners. Now look, I know what you are thinking. Where are the jingles? Where's the intro? Where's the production? What happened? He hasn't gone all PBS and Sirius on us, has he? No, no, no. Not to worry about any of that. This is different. So let me tell you what we're doing here. It's a new idea we're trying out. We'll see if it sinks or swims, but this is a Radio Free GOP Mini, which is the clever name we've come up with. And look, I know we're a little busy fighting an insane president right now, so we don't have a lot of time to screw around with clever names, so we're just going to keep that one for now. Radio Free GOP Mini, which is what we're going to do when we stumble on some interesting content, but we don't want to hang a whole show on it. We just do a quick intro, which I'm doing now, and then we put the content up for you political junkies to listen to if you are so interested. Okay, what's this about? So when I'm not fighting international crime conspiracies with my team of misfits and oddballs while juggling my cover job as a high school guidance counselor in a suburban high school filled with teenage werewolves, this is all coming soon from Warner Brothers, I'm proud to say I'm the co-director of the USC Center for the Political Future, along with center director, legendary Democratic consultant Bob Schrum. You can learn all about us if you can work Google. Just Google USC Center for the Political Future. We're all about practical politics and trying to make things work again. We do a lot of cool stuff, including plenty of panels and conferences. Every Tuesday, normally, we do some live event around 5 o'clock. You are welcome if you live in the LA area. You can find out all about it again if you can work Google and Google USC Center for the Political Future, or follow us on the Twitter at USC POL Future, Paul Future. Now, we would have put Political Future, but it was like too long and it took a lot of brain power, but we came up with a very clever idea just to shorten the damn thing. At USC POL Future. Anyway, you can learn about all this stuff there, the schedule. Again, you're welcome to attend. We also broadcast a thing on Facebook Live because we like to keep Putin up to date. You can get a link and see video. You can do all this stuff on the website. So last Tuesday, we did a fun one called, So You Need $100 Million, or maybe a billion. The topic was how finance works in big-time presidential campaigns. If you're Amy Klobuchar or Elizabeth Warren, what are you thinking about? You're thinking about how to get a message that works, how to get the right organizers, and how to raise a ton of money under the federal system, which has limits. So Bob and I recruited two super titans of campaign fundraising. Literally, there are a dozen people in the country at the top of this pyramid, and we got two of them. We had Ambassador Lou Sussman, served as our ambassador to the United Kingdom, was a huge player in the Barack Obama campaign, was national finance chairman for the Kerry for President campaign in 2004, an old-time Kennedy Democrat, very involved in their stuff, a real pro on the Democratic side. And on my side, I got my old friend Jack Oliver, who in my view has taken the crown from the late, great Ted Welch as the best political fundraiser in national politics in the Republican Party. Jack was the finance director for President George W. Bush's successful campaign in 2000. He was a co-finance chair of Bush-Cheney 04, and he was a political and finance chair of the late lamented Jeb Bush campaign. Nobody in Republican politics at the very top knows more about raising money than Jack Oliver. So we got these two pros, a room full of kids, graduate students, and interested people, and put on about an hour-long panel about how it really works. And so I have the audio of that. Again, you can see it on Facebook if you go to our link, again, at the website. One more plug, Google USC Center for the Political Future. We'd love to get you on our mailing list for other events. Before I start and just play out this audio, one point of detail that might help you decode everything. I don't want to turn into the campaign accountant here, but the federal system, states are different, but the federal system, president, Congress, etc., is highly regulated, believe it or not. So here are three technical terms that'll help you. We talk about this in the discussion, but I thought I'd do it at the beginning because it's kind of a listener's guide to the jargon. So a federal hard dollar campaign committee, like Murphy for Congress, can take a maximum of $2,600 from a God-fearing American like you. No corporate money. Your spouse could give too. So the most I could probably clip you for is about $5,200. Now that number, by the way, creeps up every cycle with inflation. This coming cycle, it may be a little higher. I'm not sure if they've released the number yet, but last time around it was $2,600. So that's the limit. Now that's the kind of money candidates love because they can do whatever they want. They can make ads that they are in and they control. They can hire yes men. They can drive around. They can put on rallies. They can fly to places. That's pure campaign committee money. But because it's limited, you need to build a a fundraising machine that either raises zillions of contributions over the internet at a small dollar, or get bundlers who can put a lot of people together in kind of a pyramid who can come up with those $2,600 individual checks. Now, let's say a really rich guy rolls in. Hey, here's $1 million. I'm Warren Buffett. Well, you got to give the money back. You can only take $2,600. You can ask him to put on a party and invite all his friends and raise a bunch of money that way. Or you can say, you know what? We'll take the million, give it to our super PAC. Now, a super PAC is a federal PAC that can take those big unlimited checks, but has certain limits on what it can do. It cannot communicate with the candidate. So the candidate can't be in the ads, the candidate can't talk strategy. It operates as kind of a friend of the campaign, but it is independent. Now, I know what you're thinking. It's politics. They all meet in shady diners and trade the information. No, you go to jail for that. So you are trying to help, but you're doing it from afar. It's helpful, but it's not the same as candidate money. Now, there's another problem. If you run a TV ad from your presidential campaign committee, you get a much better deal on TV rates from the TV stations than a super PAC does, because there's no obligation for the stations to give super PACs the special rate. So you can literally sit in the New Hampshire primary and see an ad for candidate Jones that the candidate paid $1,000 for on local TV. Then following it, you can see an ad from a super PAC, maybe for, maybe against candidate Jones, maybe for somebody else, that the super PAC paid $9,000 for. So it's complicated. Then finally, there are dark money groups that take money and don't tell anybody who they got it from. They cannot run Vote for Jones ads. They run these issue ads. Call Congressman Jones and ask him why he's such a jerk on taxes or whatever. There are some other problems with kind of how you communicate close to an election with those, but some donors like to give to groups that can take unlimited money and not talk about where they got it from. So those are the three kinds of committees. Most of what our guests talk about is how to raise the elusive but extremely useful $2,600 checks and the impact of low-dollar fundraising, which has allowed people with a good message to raise a lot of money from small contributors through the miracle of the internet. So, that's enough jabba-jabber from me. Let's go to our discussion at the University of Southern California with Jack Oliver and Ambassador Lou Sussman, Bob Strum, and I talking about how you run for president and how you find the big money. I hope you enjoy it.
Radio Free GOP.
Good evening, everybody. I'm Bob Strum, the Director of the Center for the Political Future. This is a political conversation jointly hosted by us in the Political Science Department. I have a few quick announcements. Next Tuesday, February 26th, we will host the New York Times LA Bureau Chief Adam Nagurny, former Obama campaign manager and CNN commentator Stephanie Cutter, and political science professor Jane Jun here at Ground Zero to talk about the increasingly crowded Democratic field for 2020. Our Climate Forward conference is coming on Thursday, April 4th. John Kerry will be keynoting at Bovard, followed by a full day of expert panels at Town and Gown. Admission is free for students. Undergraduate students of any major are invited to apply to become student delegates to the conference. Student delegates will have priority seating for the conference and the keynote on April 4th and can attend an all-expense-paid post-conference retreat at the USC Wrigley Marine Science Center on Catalina Island on April 5th. Delegates will participate in workshops and work closely with experts to distill key learning from the conference for dissemination. Tonight's event is being broadcast on Facebook Live, as usual, and I'm going to introduce the first of our guests, and my co-director, Mike Murphy, will introduce the second. Lou Sussman, sitting right next to Mr. Murphy, was a senior advisor to President Obama's campaign, was the national finance chairman for Senator Kerry's 2004 presidential campaign, and was a major fundraiser and force in 2008. He served as U.S. ambassador to the Court of St. James to Great Britain from 2009 to 2013. From 2012 to 2017, wonder why that was the date when it ended, he was a member of the Secretary of State's Foreign Affairs Policy Board. Also and not least, he's been a close friend of mine for a third of a century. Mike?
Thank you, Bob, and welcome, everybody. I'm the guy who often spends all the money in a campaign, so I take a very sharp professional interest in fundraising and fundraisers, and I can tell you after 30 years in the Republican Party that Jack Oliver, our guest here tonight on the Republican side, is universally known as the best Republican fundraiser in presidential politics, bar none. I'll give you a quick trip through the resume. He knows politics, too. He's a former CEO of the Republican National Committee, the National Finance Co-Chairman of Bush-Cheney 2004, the National Finance Director for George W. Bush's successful campaign in 2000, and the National Co-Chair, Political and Finance, of Jeb Bush's campaign in 2016, where he raised a tremendous amount of money, breaking records on every level until I screwed everything up in the campaign on the political side. So he's a dear friend, and before any of you liberals get too worried, he also served, because he's very involved in philanthropy, as co-chair of Bono's One campaign for 2 years. These days, he works for Doc Square. He is Doc Square Capital and is a practice leader at the Brian Cave Law Firm. So it's great to have both Ambassador Sussman and my dear friend Jack Oliver here today.
And I'm going to start with a question I'm going to direct to Lou, and then Jack can comment if he wants. How has presidential campaign fundraising changed over the years?
Gotten more expensive, that's for sure. I would tell you that the biggest change I've seen has been the internet. In my campaigns, 90% of the money was raised in fundraisers, large and small. When John Kerry, I hate to tell you this, but I go back to Teddy Kennedy, and they never had anything called the internet. And it's changed everything. If you look today, Bernie Sanders, who announced for the presidency, has over 1 million donors on his internet. He got 80% in 2016 of his money came in through that. Beto O'Rourke in Texas against Cruz, 78% of his money came in through the internet. And including one quarter, he raised $38 million. And the basic wonderful thing about that is the fact that somebody gives you $35 or $50, which is about the max, you got their vote. They've got invested. And it's pretty easy to go back and ask for another $25 or $50. So it's a whole new game. I don't think the traditional fundraising will be eliminated. I just think its importance will be less.
I would first of all thank you for hosting us tonight. I'm honored to be on the stage with my friend, Ambassador Lou Sussman. I tell everybody when I grow up, I want to be Lou Sussman. So it's an honor to be with him tonight. He's exactly right. What the internet has done is it democratized fundraising. So everybody can have a voice. You can have a voice as much as you want. And it's empowering. What you saw in the last cycle was Bernie Sanders against when he ran against Hillary Clinton. The internet fundraising for him was his voice, and it became almost such that he beat the party establishment, but for the superdelegates. And she had all the money, but he ended up having all the money from all the people. And it's exactly what Lou said, which is it, not only do you get their money, you get their vote. And it's $7, it's $13. And once you're invested, you're probably paying more attention on television. This is one of the phenomenons of Donald Trump, is how much money he's been able to raise online. And so you'll see that continue to grow, and the numbers will be extraordinary in this cycle. And frankly, it's also a very cost-effective piece of fundraising. One thing people don't realize is how much time it takes to actually raise money when you're having to contact and be with people both on the phone and in person. So it is an empowerment vehicle for people all over the country.
I just want to add one last thing I meant to say. As you use the internet, the crucial thing is the message. When John Kerry was running, it was anti-Bush. When Obama was running, it was first anti-Clinton, and a hope and an optimistic vote. And you'll see in this new round what the message is going to be. My guess is the Democrats will favor towards anti-Trump.
I would.
And
I can tell you that AOC and the Green New Deal will be on the internet fundraising for Donald Trump. So yeah, you're going to see. Because you're trying to drive your emotions, and people do a lot of giving in terms of emotional giving.
Let me ask the next question, and we're zero in a little bit. Excuse me. We've named this panel, so you need $100 million. And then we put on a subtext, or a subtitle, well, maybe make that a billion. So I'm sure, Ambassador, your phone's ringing off the hook, and Jack, you're a keen observer of how the finance dynamics work. If you're one of this gamut of Democratic candidates now sensing opportunity against the president, seeing the Democratic nomination is worth something a lot, and you're starting to compete, and they called you up, what would you tell them they have to raise to get from here to just the New Hampshire primary, the first real filter in early February? What do you think the range is? And you might explain how the federal system works, because a lot of people think you just call up Putin or the Koch brothers and get $1 trillion.
So
there's actually limits.
There are limits. Individuals can give $2,600 per person per cycle. So what becomes important outside the parties is people who have spheres of influence. Friends, people they know from synagogue, mosque, church, soccer teams, organizational structures where they have lots of friends. And those people are called bundlers, and they're very important. If you think about it, those of you who studied, running for president is like taking a company public. When you really have institutional investors in the body of politic, and those people are people who have the ability to not only have influence, whether it's union organizers or grassroots organizers, or people who have the ability to raise large sums of money. And so those people right now are looking at, do I go early? Because if you go early, there's a higher likelihood that you're going to be in the inner circle of what a campaign might look like. Do I have passion about somebody? Have I been a 30-year friend of somebody? And the Republicans are obviously primarily focused on President Trump and his reelection, but the Democrats obviously have a lot of people running. And so the attempt to get these important bundlers and or grassroots organizers involved in your campaign, both at the political level and the financial level, is the major focus of most of these most of the men and women running for president right now. And it's their value proposition is extraordinarily high, because you really do, especially the way the primary is set with California going so early, you can turn it on very quickly if you have a fundraising base and high, especially if you have Beto O'Rourke or Bernie or Elizabeth Warren, all have large numbers of people they can raise money from on the internet. But if you're Vice President Biden or some of these other people who are very well known but don't have large numbers of people who've given to them on the internet, the bundler system is much more important.
Lou, talk about bundlers for a minute if you can. Where do you find them?
Well, I can only tell you that in John Kerry's campaign, I put together a group of 10, what I called my executive committee, which were large fundraisers from all around the country, and they had to commit to raise $2 million each, and the only way they could do it was $2,600 at a pop. So they would get the lawyer, their investment banker, all these people to give, and they would bundle it, and that's what a bundler is. I don't know any other way to explain it than that. It's like Jack said, you're putting as many investors together as you can. But you asked me about how much we go in the early stages. Let me tell you something about the Democrats. It's crazy that a state called Iowa has so much influence in the election. Obviously, New Hampshire's next. In 1980, when Teddy Kennedy ran against Jimmy Carter, no one thought he would do well, and he did better than they thought. But when John Kerry ran against, at that point it was Howard Dean before he got to the Republicans, and Dean was a populist, and go ahead, we spent every single penny we had in Iowa. And what the idea was, if we didn't do well in Iowa, it was over anyway. And if we did do well, we had a plan to immediately contact the people that had given us money to go another round with them. Same thing was true with Obama. In his first race against Clinton, how do you get a black man to show well in Iowa, which is predominantly a white state? And they went all out. David Axelrod and David Plouffe spent practically every penny we had. And then that catapults you going forward, whether it's New Hampshire and now South Carolina or Super Tuesday, et cetera. So the bottom line is, how much do you need in Iowa? And Iowa's a crazy state. It's a caucus state. So it's not like you're getting votes. You got to go identify your voters, get them to the caucus understand the caucus rules, which are really definite. I always say that the primary system is worse than a colonoscopy. It's nothing could be worse. So I can suggest to you that in today's world, television's important, very important, very expensive, but it depends on the market. It isn't very expensive in Iowa, except if you use the Chicago or Kansas City markets. You go to California, it's going to cost you a bloody fortune.
Again, back to the internet and the importance of it, it also expedites your ability to take a win in one of those early primary states and catapult it onto the national stage. So again, that just reiterates what the ambassador said. It's expensive to run for president. You got to raise a lot of money, but you know, it is a pretty important job. And so one of the things you want to be able to demonstrate is whether or not you can bring resources together, not only financially, but organizationally as well. And these early primary states, the activists end up being more important than the people raising money in the individual states. So we go out and raise money from all over California, New York, Florida, Chicago, and then we go spend it all in Iowa and New Hampshire and South Carolina in hopes we win a couple of these early primary states. And if we do, we can catapult it on.
I have a question. I know this is silly, but has anybody here ever given to a campaign? It's interesting.
You shouldn't have done that. They're both going to jump you after you vent to double the number. Quick Iowa story, because it was Ambassador Sussman is so right about how an Iowa caucus works. I'll never forget the first one I worked in the mid-90s. The governor at the time was a client and said, look, I'm not going to endorse your candidate. I'm not going to endorse anybody, but I'm for your guy. So I'm giving you the most valuable gift in Iowa caucus politics. Hands me an envelope. I open it up, and it's the home phone number, and some of them had cell phones then, of the top 200 rural veterinarians in Iowa. Because you caucus in a rural county, nobody wants to piss off the vet. They're going to call in the middle of the night to come out to their farm in 10-degree weather. And so if you got the vet, the crowd dynamic power is incredible. That's the kind of stuff you don't see on polls. So what I often hear from kind of civilians is, oh, I know how this works. You give your maximum of 2,600 or get your 10 friends to do it in bundle. But that's because these people all want road contracts. You know, they pay to get. So I'd ask our guest, in your experience, is that really true? Because I think it's a misnomer. Why do people give?
Well, I think people would give mainly emotionally. Who do they feel is the person they want, and they feel an emotional attachment? I've seen it time and time again. And for an example, in the Bush race against Kerry, Iraq was a big issue. I tell the story. By the way, Professor Shrum was running that campaign, so you all should know that. It's changed. It's generational. I'll never forget, we had two fabulous people from Stanford that came to see me, and they said, Mr. Sussman, we have a great idea that we can raise $7 million in 10 days. I looked at them that they were crazy. And I said, first place, don't call me Mr. Sussman. It's my father. I'm Lou. They said, yes, Mr. Sussman. And I said, what do you want? He said, we want these 10 names to write a letter for us, which we'll send out over 10 days. And it was Jimmy Carter. It was Madeleine Albright. It was a whole series of those type of people. And they had a thermometer on the internet. And I looked at them like they're crazy, but I got them the 10 names. We did 7,800,000 in 10 days.
And what's so interesting about this is, why do people give? They give for lots of different reasons. The person that asked them may be the reason they gave. They give emotionally. They give because they like the candidate or don't like the other candidate. They give because they want to be a part of something bigger than themselves. You know, whether it's a $10 check or a $2,600 check. So yes, there's lots of different reasons people give to politics. It's part of the process. It's always been part of the process. It does get a lot of, there are a lot of misunderstandings and misnomers about it. And now, you know, the truth is, with some of these super PACs, you have individuals on the left and on the right who can't coordinate with the campaign, and they don't coordinate with the campaign. And sometimes they go out and put messages on television that are frankly not helpful to your candidacy. But people with a tremendous amount of resources spend a lot of money on politics, just like they do on other things. And so you have this giant ecosystem of politics that now has changed Washington for some people would say the good, I would say the bad, because there's a permanent campaign. when in the '80s and even into the late '80s and the early '90s, my great friend in life, President George H.W. Bush, died this year, Jeb's dad and mom. And, you know, in his generation, you did have politics, but politics ended, and then you tried to actually get something done. And what we've seen with the proliferation of news stations and kind of your own ability to create your own news vacuum with people who agree with you on 99% of the things that you think is it never stops. And so no matter which side you might be on, the permanent campaign has taken our ability to kind of work across party lines, because the extremes of both parties now drive a lot of both the grassroots organizational structure, fundraising, and the primary process. And as a result, there's no benefit for a man or woman who's a Republican or Democrat working across party lines to try to actually accomplish something for the good of the country.
I hate to be a cynic, but I think you'll understand. Guess what? Somebody might want to give money to get a job. I can't tell you how many times I've been said, well, how much money do I have to give to be an ambassador? Or how much money do I have to give to be something? Well, that's the first place, it's against the law. So that was the easy answer. But don't think that it's totally virtuous.
Well, I don't want to take away all their idealism about politics. My favorite thing when somebody asks that question is, where do you want me to send the check back to? So that goes on, but not really. It's an overblown piece. And you know, the truth is, you create a series of friends throughout this process, and you try to accomplish what it is you're trying to set out to do.
You mentioned super PACs. Mm-hmm. Talk to us about super PACs, how they work, and about dark money issue advocacy groups that don't even have to report their donors.
So
I know it's two different questions.
Two different questions. Super PACs are organizational structures that you file with the election commission so that you know that who is giving money to that super PAC, and then any expenditures by that super PAC is on television.
Why have a super PAC though? Why not just give to the campaign?
Because the campaign is limited in the amount of money you can raise. And so there are people who want to give more than $2,600, and the law technically allowed it, and it was created and it was off and running, but you're not allowed to coordinate. Unfortunately, I never got to talk to Mike after we announced whatever that was. So, but super PACs are disclosed. The dark money or whatever, there is a mechanism in the law that allows you to, if you issue advocacy under the tax code, that money is under a C4 disclosure and is not disclosed. And a lot of people are very critical on the left and on the right about these issue campaigns that are run external to the campaigns themselves. And frankly, to be honest with you, most of them end up being worse for the candidate than if they wouldn't have done it. But it is a very controversial piece because you have people not knowing where the money is coming from. And at least on the Republican side of the aisle, our whole goal was for disclosure and transparency so that you can figure out where the money's coming from. If you don't like that, you don't like the money or the people that are supporting your candidate or the person against you, you have the greatest thing you can do in the world, which is vote against them. And that's why transparency is so important.
But there's two types of super PACs. Hillary Clinton had a super PAC in which people could give money to her campaign, could cover some of her expenses, could take care of certain things that they didn't have to spend the money on with the $2,600. But they could not coordinate with the campaign, which was BS, because they figured out a way to do it. But then there's the super PAC that's run by the Association of Pharmaceuticals. And they were issue PACs that they could go, and if Hillary Clinton was against pharmaceuticals, they ran issue ads. And while they never mentioned Clinton, they could definitely influence the election. The other PAC, the dark money Bob talks about, I believe that one of the greatest threats to democracy was the United case that the Supreme Court said, which people could give unlimited money and you didn't have to say where it came from. I think that is dangerous. I think it shouldn't be allowed. I'm hoping one of these days the Congress will reverse that through legislation. But when you have somebody like the Koch brothers,
or Tom Steyer,
or Tom Steyer, or whoever can give dark money, it's it works on both sides of the aisle. But I'm telling you, it's dangerous. You should be against it.
And my favorite thing about the country today is people are so much more able to get information, and so people are, I think, making educated decisions based on that, which is something that's very important, as I said, with regard to disclosure.
Not to sound like the campaign accountant, but I want to just quickly rehash this because it's such a complicated thing, but it's very important. I run for president. I go to Bob. Bob says, I'm for you. What can I do? I'll give you $2,600, the limit, not from a corporation, from an individual. I say, great. That's my favorite kind of money. Now get 50 friends to do it. Call Ambassador Sussman to figure out how to do that. Because I can use that money to pay for my hotel room in New Hampshire, to hire an organizer, to make an ad where I'm talking. Then Bob says, I want to give you $1 million. Well, the campaign can't take that, but the super PAC run by my friends can. Now, they can't talk to me, but they kind of know what I want. They do their own polling. They do their own stuff. They do their own TV, although I can't show up and do a filming with them. So it's easier to raise, but it's clumsier money, but it's disclosed.
And more importantly, and also, Mike, it's also 10 times more expensive, right? So in New Hampshire, your candidate committee gets a discounted rate, whereas there's no
for TV ads,
but super PACs don't get that, and the TV stations love it.
Yeah, they gouge them. They have no right to the air. So you could have two spots running on New Hampshire on the news, one a candidate paid $500 for, and right after it, a super PAC spot that costs $6,000. So it's kind of a weird thing, but that becomes an arms race. Then finally, Bob says, well, I would give you $1 million, but it turns out I'm a massive criminal, and I don't want to read my name in the paper. Well, then you could give to the dark money committee, which doesn't report its donors, but the ads they run have to be different. One, they get hit on the same high rates by TV, and their ads say, hey, if you like ice cream, vote for Mike Murphy. If you don't like ice cream, call up Jack Oliver and ask him why he murdered 7 ice cream vendors. Here's his phone number.
It literally is that stupid.
Yeah, it really is that dumb. And there are certain controls. So the dark money is more controlled. The truth is, there wasn't that much dark money in the Republican primary. Marco Rubio was the only guy who had a big committee doing kind of those half ads. But I'm with, I think, Jack and Lou on this. The dark money is not only a problem because it does allow mystery, no disclosure. It often works like a hand grenade rolling around on its own out of control. And that's where some of the slippery stuff happens. So super PACs, I think, and I just ran the biggest Republican one ever, thanks to a lot of money Jack and Jeb raised, and they have a certain limited utility because you can't really you can argue for the candidate, but the candidate can't be inside it, so you don't have that authenticity. That said, it can be helpful, and it's a boom area. People are raising a lot.
You know, the other question is, there's a famous California politician named Jeffrey Unruh. And he said the mother milk of politics is money. How do you get money out of these things? Do you have to be a millionaire or multimillionaire to run? I think the internet has kind of modified that a lot, where in the past it was easier. I worked with a number of people, both across the aisle from Russ Feingold to McCain, to try and figure out if we could figure a way to take money out of it and have it funded by the federal government. Do you know who was against it the most? The incumbent politicians. Because they knew they could raise money and they had an unfair a playing field to somebody that came in. And it's been batted around how to do it, et cetera. You should know, which is one of the only disagreements I've had with Professor Shrum, in the federal, when you get to the out of the primaries, you can opt out for government money, which has a limit on it, but you don't have to raise any. And we decided to take that money for reasons. Bob thought it was a mistake. He could be right in retrospect. But you do get money out of the politics in the past, where both candidates took the federal money. I'm not sure they do it anymore.
No, I don't think anyone will ever do it again, because you had raised and the internet had raised $250 million for John Kerry before the convention. He had his convention 5 weeks before Bush. He had to live, when he took federal money, on the same amount of money for a 13-week campaign that Bush had for a 5-week campaign. So Barack Obama looked at this and in 2008 said, I'm not taking federal money. McCain took federal money and was tremendously outspent. Right. And since then, no candidate of either party for president has taken federal money.
And they won't. I mean, look, we spend, $5 billion a year in pornography in the country, and we spend $1 billion every 4 years to elect a president. So, I mean, you put it in context, it's not a lot of money in the overall processes of the world. That being said, I go back to what I said the first time. The internet has empowered people's voice in a way that nothing you've ever seen has been able to do, to get people that can give small amounts of money. Because with the right idea and the right personnel, look at the race in Texas. Beto O'Rourke raised a tremendous amount of money. His average contribution was teeny. It was from all over the country.
And he never held a fundraiser.
I don't know if he had a fundraiser or not. He didn't need to. And by the way, remember, it doesn't cost money to utilize the internet. So it's a very powerful thing.
Yeah, because when you do the high dollar money, the $2,600 parties with 30 of your friends, you got to fly in the candidate. You got to hire staff. There's going to be a nice sculpture of a big eagle. So there's cost. Well, the internet is as internet people say, low friction, which means you can capture 94 cents on the buck given to you, and nothing can beat that. And times a million people, it's a lot of money. So here's a question for you guys about the mechanics of all this. Right now, you got a bunch of Democratic candidates running. How do they go about courting these bundlers? I've got to build the, how do they go out and recruit them? Let's say I'm Amy Klobuchar now, and I've got five bundlers in Minnesota, and somebody I went to law school with that lives in Nevada. How do I get the known 100? How do I go get them? How do I compete?
Well, the first thing is there'll be some people she doesn't even know. Say, I want to be for Amy Klobuchar, and will become a bundler. The second thing is use the network of the bundlers you have to find other bundlers. As much as bundlers are important today, they're not going to go out of style, but their importance is substantially diminished because of the internet. And I always said on bundlers, the only two bundlers could decide is what the third bundler should give. And it's a tough go. But, I can only tell you got to ask yourself the question. With all this money is going to be spent, where it's $100 million, or as Bob and Mike said, $1 billion, how do you get money out of politics? How do you create a system that, whatever it is, I would tell you that I worked hard on it and failed.
If you're a well-known bundler from some part of the country, every one of these people knows when your birthday is. They know your children's names. They know what your hobbies are. They know they've tried to see you when they were in the Senate or in the Congress or a governor to build a relationship. And so you get to know them so that you can take this personal aspect of it and add to it a series of ideology that you're strongly excited about. So it's a process that is time consuming and can be not a fun and favorite thing of a candidate. But in this world that we live in, it's part of the process. It is very difficult to get people to commit early, especially if you have lots of candidates, unless they think you're going to win. The most important ideology in a year when you have either you're running against after 8 years of President Obama or you're running after 4 years of President Donald Trump, the most important thing that a donor, just like for most part activists, is your ability to win the election. And so these candidates will be able to show polling that shows them early doing well against President Trump, will have an added advantage when they're talking to either you on the internet or on whatever mechanism by which you're getting your news, or whether they're flying to Chicago to see Ambassador Sussman.
One thing is important we did in this, it's called LIST. All these people need LIST. How do they reach you? How do they entice you? What's their message they give to you? Bernie Sanders has a list of almost 1 million people. Beto O'Rourke's got 800,000. venture to say that Amy Klobuchar, if she's lucky, got 200,000, if that. And so she has to create lists for this internet to work. And a lot of these lists are bought and sold back and forth. It's a big business. I feel that I'm at my age, I'm getting a little tired of dialing for dollars. But I would tell you, you can't make it without the money.
So I'm going to shift gears for a second, and I'll give this to you first, Lou, and then you comment on it, especially on the left. Contributions from Wall Street can be viewed as a negative for a candidate. We saw this with Hillary Clinton, the speeches she was paid to give, the folks who gave her money. We're starting to hear a similar criticism of Cory Booker. Can a Democratic candidate be successful post Bernie Sanders and still take big contributions from corporate executives or Wall Street investors?
I don't think they can do it if they're getting paid $250,000 for a speech. That doesn't work anymore. But you go to Goldman Sachs, and they put a group together of 50 of their partners, and each of them give $2,600, and their wife gives $2,600. That's called high-class bundlers. And I think that only Elizabeth Warren, I think, would criticize that. But I don't think anybody else would, because they're all doing the same thing. I think your point is, if it looks like you're being bought by Wall Street, then you got a problem.
Each party has a group of people that they become the people that you don't want to be involved with. Well, on the Democratic side, I can't imagine Elizabeth Warren raising money from the NRA or Goldman Sachs or others. To be successful in a presidential campaign, you need to raise money from all kinds of people, and so I think the degree to which there will be heat given to the Democrats who go into Wall Street and raise resources, it's kind of an interesting thing, because if you go back and look at a lot of the cabinet secretaries that we've had on the Democratic side, a lot of them have come out of Wall Street, and Wall Street is not a bad place. There are bad people on Wall Street, just like there are bad people in Hollywood. And so I'm one who hopes that if there's a nice, good liberal Democrat in Goldman Sachs who wants Elizabeth Warren to be president, that he or she should be able to do whatever they want to try to get that done. And if that means bringing together some of their friends with their partners and the other people in their world to try to raise money for them, more power too. I don't think she'll take money from it, because I think she thinks it's an activist issue that can fire up the base against a Joe Biden, against somebody that's more of an establishment person. But we'll see. It'll be interesting to see. This is kind of more inside baseball stuff than I think the general public is focused on, because Barack Obama took plenty of money from Wall Street.
I know, but if you look at what happened in 2016, when Hillary Clinton was asked in a debate whether she'd reveal her speech, the text of her Wall Street speeches,
so
said, "I will." And if everybody else will reveal those. And Bernie threw his hands up and said, here's mine. I never gave any.
Right.
Big issue.
And it is different than raising money. That's exactly. So she got paid $250,000 a speech when she was a private citizen to go speak. And that, with the Clinton Foundation, probably created more problems than they would like to have done. But I do think it'll be an issue debate, because if you're the 12th person on the stage and you're trying to get recognized, if this is something that can provide sensational television, you're probably going to jump up.
Let me ask a contrarian question, then I know we got to go to audience Q&A. But I think we've all agreed that the rise of the internet means a way to democratize fundraising, lots of people giving a smaller amount, responding to a message or a huge candidate list, as opposed to the bundlers. But a lot of the bundlers I've met are ultra pragmatic. I don't think there's a lot of enthusiasm at the leadership level of the Democratic Party for Bernie to run again. In the old days, Bernie would go up in front of 100 bundlers and they'd say, hey, you're a loser, take a hike. Maybe he had relationships of 5 or 6, but it would be a chilling effect. Now, because he has his own list, he can blow away what Kamala Harris raised in 24 hours in just 4 hours, because his loyal people are there. So is the decline of bundlers necessarily a good thing? Or does it open it up and maybe there's less discipline and pragmatism at the top of the finance machine that makes candidacies possible or not in the primaries?
I'll let Lou give comment to that. I would say this. anybody who is interested in politics but wants to give money at the grassroots level or at the bundlers level, there's a process by which you make a determination on why you're doing it and how you're doing it. And if you're going to run for president, he or she, the person needs to be able to figure out how to communicate with both those people. They're both important part of the processes. The head of labor unions are very important people, and they, because they represent a lot of people. The head of these different groups are important because they're there to represent a lot of people. Bundlers are no different. They're in most cases motivated by trying to do what they think is best for the country, just like people who give money. I do think, as we said earlier, the internet has changed the ability of the organizational structure and leadership in both the Democratic National Committee and the third party groups that make up the leadership of the Democrats, and the same thing on the right. It has taken their power down in determining who the nominee, whoever she or he may be. And I think that's the thing that's changed as a result of super PACs and people who have lots of money and want to get involved, and more importantly, the rise of the grassroots fundraising.
Lou, would Bernie Sanders be a viable candidate 25 or 30 years ago?
I don't think so.
Because?
I don't think he could raise the money. But I think you got to, if you're going to run for a national office, you can't eliminate any source of fair legal revenue.
Right.
And whether it's a bundler or it's a thing. You will see, though, a number of the candidates, and I don't know how many have already done it, will not accept money from PACs for PACs. They feel that the influence is undue, the image is bad, whatever it might be. I don't know. I know Warren has. I know that Bernie has. And I don't know where the rest of them have come out on that. But let me also tell you a story that I know. When the Kennedy family ran, they had terrific fundraisers that were for teas, for luncheons, where they gave $100 a pop. And those were bundlers bringing in $100 a pop. You can do it at the ground level if you got the right candidate and the right issues. It's an enormously organization thing. But I can't impress upon you enough that if somebody gives you $50, you got their vote. That is crucial.
And you're probably going to get another $50.
Right.
Because they're already invested, just like you invested in the things you believe in and the things you're involved with.
Bob, shall we go to Q&A?
Yeah, I think we should open this up to Q&A from the audience. There's someone out there with a mic. So he's over there. Just put your hands up.
Gentleman in the back.
Hi there. So on the subject of exceedingly wealthy individuals trying to buy their way into positions, it seems like in this previous election, we have several mega donors of Donald Trump who have made his way into his cabinet. For example, the DeVos family who donated millions of dollars or what have you. You have, I'm blanking up here, but it does seem that that's kind of unenforceable, even if you do see some really apparent connections.
Well, I would go back to President Obama's cabinet. There was a wonderful woman, Penny Pritzker, out of Chicago, who was his finance chairman, who served as the Commerce Department. Look, people, you're going to choose people that you're close to and you think will do a good job. It's up to you all to decide whether or not that's the case or not. I can't speak for President Trump or the cabinet. I'm not involved.
You don't want to speak for President Trump?
No. President Bush put good friends of his around his cabinet, some of whom gave money to us, some of whom did not. That wasn't the qualifying factor as to whether or not you want to put somebody in the cabinet. One of the things that I think is so interesting in what people that aren't involved in this is, one of the things President Trump did was he was new to this process. So all of the kind of institutional people on the Republican side that you would know, governors, senators, congresswomen, congressmen, people that were involved in commerce, he didn't know them. And then he won, and most people didn't think that was going to happen either. So he put a cabinet together very quickly. I'm not questioning or judging those. He's put a lot of really good people on there. I'd put Jim Mattis in the cabinet of any place I ever did. I'd do the same with Mike Pompeo. We can go down the list. There are some extraordinary people that Gary Cohen, who worked in the White House, Dina Powell. These are extraordinary people in some cases are Democrats. So Were there friends of his who gave money? I'm sure there were. That is not a Republican unique thing to Republicans. It happens on the Democratic side just as well. And the good news is, and every the Senate then confirms or denies that person, and then you have a chance to see what how he or she may do, and you judge on the outside.
I think, again, being the cynic in the crowd, I know, and this is public, I'm not telling these stories, but the present ambassador to the Court of St. James is the owner of the New York Jets.
My good friend.
Your good friend. New York Jets football team, and is the heir to the Johnson & Johnson fortune. And he gave $3.5 million to the Trump campaign. Now, how did he give $3.5 million? Well, he gave to the Republican Party. He gave to super PACs, wherever. I would only suggest to you that whether it's true or not, there's more rich Republicans than there are Democrats.
I wish it was true. Unfortunately, in the world, it's not. I mean, especially if you're out here, my friend. I mean, you know, you can go up and down Hollywood Hills. And
it's a fair fight.
This is a better fundraiser, better fundraising area for you, just like San Francisco.
But what I wanted to say is that people that were chosen for the Obama cabinet, I can honestly say, because Jim Johnson was involved and I was involved, I don't know anyone that, quote, bought their way in.
I certainly wasn't suggesting anyone did. I just wanted to say there were people involved in both campaigns that ended up being involved in it. Penny Pritzker is an extraordinary human being. She did a great job for President Obama. I'd say it if she was sitting right here. But just because you give money to somebody you believe in and you give time of it, that doesn't necessarily make you a nefarious person. It also means there may be other people, but just so you know, that doesn't automatically become something that's nefarious.
And just very quickly, I feel like I have to say something about Betsy DeVos. I've been anti-Trump since 1992. I'm wondering all the Johnny Come Latelys came from. And you can decide whether Betsy DeVos ought to be or shouldn't be education secretary. I will say, going back to John Engler's campaign in 1990, which I ran in Michigan, she's been involved in education reform for a long time at a high level. So she does have credentials in education reform. It's not like she woke up one day and decided, you know, I don't want to buy a Ming vase. I'm going to buy sec education. It's just not accurate. Nor have they been the biggest mega donors in the party. That said, it is a long American tradition, particularly in the ambassador area, that often donors, who are also fairly accomplished people, often wind up in service as ambassadors. Go ahead, Lou, and then we'll get another question.
I also think that we haven't mentioned some outside groups. For an example, how much did the NRA spend in the last election?
I have no idea.
How much did the unions spend
in the last election? I don't know election? How much did Tom Steyer spend.
Yeah, and all I'm suggesting to you, there are people with definite parochial issues they deal with. One of the largest contributors to the campaign are people that were in the pharmaceutical industry. They call up the pharmaceutical industry and they said, we're having an inaugural, will you give $100 million? Well, yeah. Are they going to say no to Trump's finance chairman at this point? So there's all that money.
And that, unfortunately, Lou, as you know, is not a Republican problem. It happened the same thing with President Obama.
Oh, yeah. I'm saying
they got the same phone call.
There's a special interest.
Okay.
Out there.
So this gentleman here paid $1 million to ask the next question. Oh, I thought your hand was up. Who do we have? There you go. $500,000.
Hi there. Thank you so much for coming out. It's been really interesting to hear your perspective so far. I recently read that President Trump has raised an unprecedented amount at this point for the 2020 election. I believe it's over $100 million. And I was wondering, do you see that continuing to increase in like 2024? Or do you think that he's a bit of an anomaly?
I think as I said earlier, the campaign never stopped. I don't think the campaign will stop. If a Democrat wins, I don't think their campaign will stop either.
But Jack, you can correct me. Trump has been an underperformance in traditional finance levels.
President Trump has raised a ton of money online a ton.
Yeah,
and that's been a mechanism for him. He has not stopped the political conversation. Decide whether you will, whether it's good or bad. He has not stopped the political conversation. And so that has not stopped. And whether you're on Facebook or some other place and getting the advertising, that's been a big part of what he's done. So I don't think that's going to stop. As I said, we've really stopped since 1996, maybe. From 90, maybe 2000, and maybe 2004, but it doesn't, politics doesn't stop anymore. The day you get elected, whether you're Republican or Democrat to Congress, you're trying to figure out whether or not you're going to get reelected or to the Senate, or are you going to term limit out so you can run for governor? I mean, these are people who spend a lot of time thinking about those things.
Just put this in perspective. 30 years ago, a very tight Senate race in Missouri I was involved in. The lieutenant governor ran against an incumbent senator and a very, very rich man, and he won and spent $260,000.
And then very good man.
And then they ran in the general against a congressman who had been there for years, and they spent $270,000. Multiply that to what that is worth today in inflation, etc. But today, it was unheard of for a congressional race to cost $1 million. Today, a congressional race might cost $10 million. So the influence of money is there. Don't ever think it isn't.
By the way, you mentioned that he's raised $100 million so far. I would bet that by the time we get to November of 2020, each of the major party nominees will have, in the primaries and the general, spent $1 billion.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
It'll be a $2 billion election.
For sure. Yes, sir. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to not choose you. No.
He doesn't like the Nike shirt. That's
the problem.
I love
Nike. 1972. I mean, you might even know who Teddy Kennedy was.
So to crystallize, does the panel believe that the federal presidential campaign finance laws in a post-Citizens United world are healthy or harmful for American democracies, and what measures, if any, should be taken to limit the influence of wealthy donors, even though their influence doesn't necessarily manifest as quid pro quo, but does manifest as increased access?
I mean, the head of the AFL-CIO has more access than any donor, period. Okay? So don't necessarily assume that cash is the most valuable asset. I'm just if you represent a lot of people or a cause, you can have that kind of access to. The campaign finance laws needs to be brought up to speed on where the country is today. This construct that we have, you know, general primary, you can't raise money in the general till the primary is over. You know, the matching funds, which will never be done before. It all needs to be updated. But as the ambassador said, in Washington, campaign finance is really not Republican versus Democrat.
I think we need to get dark money out. I think we need to have greater restrictions on PACs, both independent PACs and candidates' PACs. And I think that there ought to be a view of limits, how much you can raise. Theoretically, in Iowa, there's a limit on how much you can raise. What happens if you raise more? Their election commission slaps you on the wrist. So I'm from the school that I would love to get big money out of politics.
And you'd like to put a total cap on what a candidate can raise and spend. Yeah.
So I would be opposed to that, because if I don't know anybody and I'm running against Barack Obama for re-election, I have no chance, because he's on television every night on NBC News, ABC News, and he's got the power of the White House, which is the biggest campaign operation in the history of the world. So it depends on what you want. If you want the ability for other people to have a voice, then I would not be for limiting.
I'm for the libertarian kind of view, which is I would get rid of super PACs. Though getting rid of anything is really hard, because, you know, the court has ruled that spending is speech. So we'll put the legality aside. But I think super PACs and particularly dark money organizations are very problematical. I would remove the $2,600 level on what people can give an actual candidate. Instant disclosure, they're responsible for taking the check, and they totally control how it's spent with full disclosure. So the buck stops with the person on the ballot. But that would raise the amount of money people could give. But then you can debate it. I'm not going to vote for Snodgrass because he took $100,000 from Bob Schrum or whatever. But I think caps are a bit arbitrary, particularly when we spend more money on pet food than we do on politics. Now,
and pornography, remember.
Yeah, not to mention pet food and pornography. Then you get into real dollars. If we were to make television ads cheaper or the cost of communication cheaper, then it's something to talk about. Sir, over here.
Hey, guys. My name's Neil. And so you guys mentioned a lot of reasons people give. So I was really curious, what do you guys do on the fundraising side to kind of elicit that? And especially with the rise of the internet and how you get people to donate through the internet.
I think it's the message. Okay. Strictly the message. In all the Democrats will have a form of a message anti-Trump that we'll put out there, and what resonates will cause people to give. I think that when Beto O'Rourke ran against Cruz, and you can say this, it was equally Beto, but it was equal anti-Cruz. He was very unpopular. And by the way, he won by 3 percentage points in a very, very red state. So the answer to your first question is, how do you get people to give on the internet? I think it's the message. The second way is, you got to be creative. I will tell you one of my greatest fundraiser successes. In 1980, Teddy Kennedy ran against the President of the United States, Jimmy Carter. It was a Don Quixote campaign. In my state of Missouri, I had the two senators against me, the congressman and the governor, and I was supposed to raise money. I didn't know how I was going to raise money. So I came up with the most creative idea I've ever had. I brought in Jacqueline Kennedy to head a fundraiser. We sold it out, and many Republicans gave because they just wanted to come meet Jackie. My point being is, it's how you reach out to people, what they want to hear, what they want to see. But in the internet, it's all message, in my opinion.
My goal is to make you feel like you're part of something bigger than yourself, and that your role in that is not just to write a check, but that you have other pieces to which your life can become a bigger player into the world that you're trying to have an impact on. So I'm trying to figure out what motivates you, how to talk to you, what you like, and hopefully get your birthday so I can send you a birthday note. I'm going to make sure you sign up for something that out of a million people, one person's going to get to go hang out backstage with my candidate before he or she goes on stage. I'm just going to try to find ways to make you engage more than just one time in what we're trying to accomplish. And that's a big part of message, but it's also personalization and making you feel like you're involved in something bigger than yourself.
And the huge thing is, this is a flip. In the old days, you'd raise the money from the bundlers. You'd hire people like me or Schrum to work on the message and put up advertising to move the polls to raise more money to win. Now you get the message right and you put it on the internet, then the money comes in. So it used to be money then message, now it's message then money.
So one more quick question. Wherever. I can't see very well. So
if the Supreme Court does remove individual campaign contribution limits, which does seem possible now, what do you think will be the main impacts on American politics when it comes to campaigns?
Well, it'll certainly not be good for people who organize super PACs.
You'll have people giving, some people will give more money, some people will give less. My guess is you won't have a lot more money in the system than you otherwise would. You probably have it in a situation where its disclosure is more to the candidate so that he or she can control the message themselves. You'll have more transparency in that regard, and you won't have this dark money concern. There will be lots of people who will think that it's, you know, going to cause lots of problems. Look, at the end of the day, and this sounds very idealistic, if you don't like somebody, don't vote for them. If you think they're a crook, don't vote for them. If you think they're taking money from somebody they shouldn't be taking money for, don't vote for them. Tell your friends, tell your sister, tell your partner, tell whomever it is. Engage in the conversation of trying to stop them. That's the one thing that we've learned, is you can stop the system. It almost happened with Bernie Sanders. It sure happened in the Republican primary. The voters said, enough with you. We think it's great you think that, you know, Jeb Bush or Marco Rubio or Ted Cruz or Chris Christie's best thing since sliced bread. We want somebody who's going to come up and blow up the system. And they did it. And they beat all of us along the way. The same thing was true. I mean, the same thing happened to Hillary the first time against Barack Obama and almost happened to her the second time against Bernie Sanders. If the system would have been allowed to happen, she never would have been the nominee. So you can do that. It's there, and we've just seen the last two cycles, an example on the Republican side, an example on the Democratic side, where the voters spoke, and they, in one case they won, in the other case they almost won.
I think your question was, if they take out the limits, what's the impact? Right? Is that what you were saying? I think it will be horrendous. You will see the rise of special interest groups. You'll see the rise of individuals giving enormous amounts of monies. You'll see situations where candidates will try and buy the election. I still think there'll be PACs of some kind. But what's Mayor Bloomberg do if there's no limits? Mayor Bloomberg today in the Democratic Party, if he could buy the election, he'd win. But you can't buy the election in Iowa. You can't buy the election in New Hampshire. It turns out that here's a man that's got umpteen billions, and he wants to be president, and he doesn't know how to do it. So all I can suggest to you is your assumption that they take off the limits, I hope never happens.
We're going to wind up. I have to conclude with a short story. In 1860, at the Republican convention, Abraham Lincoln was fighting hard against someone named William Seward from New York for the Republican nomination. He would later appoint him his Secretary of State, thus team of rivals. And there was a very corrupt governor of Pennsylvania named Simon Cameron, who said, "I'll throw our votes to Lincoln if Lincoln will agree to make me Secretary of the Treasury." And Lincoln, sort of anticipating this, and either to cover his rear end or because he really felt it, sent a telegram to his campaign manager, David Davis, whom Lincoln later appointed to the U.S. Supreme Court. So lots of things stay the same, by the way. And the telegram said, "Make no deals, I will be bound by none." And Davis looked at it and he said, "Lincoln ain't here, made the deal." They wouldn't appoint Simon Cameron in the end Secretary of the Treasury because he was an incredible thief. They've made him Secretary of War, and a year in, he got caught making profiteering off the making of uniforms for soldiers. And so they sent him to, you'll like this, Lou, they sent him to St. Petersburg, which as the ambassador, which in 1862 was about as far as you could be sent in the world. You'd never be heard of again. So human nature doesn't change in politics. Fundraising is part of that human nature. I want to thank Jack. This was great. I want to thank Lou. I have so many things to thank Lou for over so many years. And it's great to do this with Murphy. And I want to thank Lisa Korbatoff, whose generosity has helped make so many of these programs possible. Thank you all, and we'll see you next week, and we'll talk about the Democrats.
Thank you.
Okay, I hope you enjoyed that masterclass on how big money is raised for presidential campaigns. We got enough of them breaking out. They should tune in too. It was a very interesting thing and everybody enjoyed the event. If you want to help, if you're moved by the discussion to write a check, just make it out to the Committee Against Secular Humanism or CASH and send it either to the Christian Right or to me. I'll put it to good work, I promise. Seriously, if you want to hear more about what we're doing at USC or visit one of our many panel discussions and conferences, you can learn all about us if you Google USC Center for the Political Future or follow us on Twitter at USCPOLPaulFuture. There's also, as I said before, a link to a Facebook live feed so you can see that panel and others in video. All right, thanks again. We will be back soon from the undisclosed location with another full episode of Radio Free GOP, the voice of the Republican resistance.
All across the nation, let's put crazy on the run. Tell your friends to listen in. Our podcast will be fun. Radio Free GOP.
This has been Radio Free GOP, the voice of the Republican resistance, with your host, Mike Murphy.